Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bank of America makes yet another try to fix the housing market. The Supreme Court as a geeky tourist attraction. What's up with all those Nigerian scammers anyway? And the weekly wrap, just for good measure, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, everybody. This one's the 23rd of March. Good as always to have you with us. There have been, what, half a dozen or more federal programs meant to help struggling homeowners the past 3 or 4 years, right? Refinancing, mortgage assistance. The government has tried pretty much everything. Nothing has really worked so far. But today, Bank of America came up with something newish. B of A is offering a select group of customers the chance to wipe away their mortgages and stay in their homes as tenants. Mortgage to lease is what it's being called. It's a pilot program, to be sure, open to less than 1,000 B of A mortgage holders in three states who are at the end of their foreclosure ropes. But if it works, it would be something that works. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Like many Phoenix homeowners, Sharon Gallagher owes far more on her mortgage than her house is actually worth. She says she's considered walking away from a home she's convinced will never be worth her total investment. So Gallagher is intrigued by the idea that she could wipe away her mortgage obligation for a more affordable payment with only a limited impact to her credit score.
If we wouldn't have a major drop in our credit rating, that would be the biggest appeal to me. I would probably take full advantage of it and then just find another home.
Homeowner advocacy groups are welcoming Bank of America's pilot program. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
I'm ready to throw roses in front of any banks that are taking initiatives to try to get ahead of the foreclosure problem.
Taylor suggests a further incentive to help acceptance of the program, giving the homeowners-turned-renters the chance to buy back the title to their home if they stay current on payments. Bank of America told us today there is nothing to restrict the original owner from acquiring the property again. At Washington Center for Economic Policy and Research, Dean Baker says if the program works, it could help ease the foreclosure fallout across the country.
This is the sort of thing that prevents the blight of foreclosure that has been so devastating for many communities, because if you keep someone in the home as a tenant, a long-term tenant who knows they could stay there for 3 years, they have a really strong incentive to keep the place up, even though they're not an owner.
Phoenix homeowner Sharon Gallagher remains skeptical, though, that she'll ever receive this kind of offer. She's been searching for some kind of solution to her mortgage troubles for more than 2 years now.
I'm just trying to figure out what else they have to gain. I don't trust banks particularly.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Time now to pause and reflect on the 5 days gone by and the business and economic happenings therein. So today for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore with us. Also Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville in the cozy confines of our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hello, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So, Heidi, we start with you and this thing that broke on Bloomberg late-ish this afternoon, that John Corzine, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, former member of the United States Senate, former governor of New Jersey, and former CEO of a company named MF Global, he's the guy who moved the money, that hundreds of millions of dollars that went missing. Big, big deal, right?
Yeah, all those former titles, and he's a current perjurer because he testified to Congress that he had no idea where this money went. And it's very important, you know, customer money on Wall Street is supposed to stay separate from the firm's own money. And he mingled them, which is a huge crime. It might even be fraud. And then he apparently lied to Congress about it, according to this new memo. It's really enormous and very disappointing.
Cardiff, you agree?
Well, let me put it this way. In the memo, it cited, quote, direct instructions from initialed JC.
Right.
And unless it turns out that the treasurer is a very religious person and JC stands for Jesus Christ, I don't see how this is anything but just a really strong indictment of Corzine. I don't see any way out of this, to be honest.
You think he's going to jail?
Possibly.
Yeah.
You know, these things are always tough to predict.
All
but
right,
yeah, possibly.
Yeah. More to come on that one, I guess, as the weekend and Monday unfold. Heidi, let me go to you and what we thought was going to be the big global economic lead story of today. Jim Yong Kim, president of Dartmouth College, a physician and anthropologist by training, and now the guy who's going to run the World Bank, the White House said this morning.
Yeah, a black horse like you haven't even seen before. You know, everyone was shocked, and then everyone was really surprised he wasn't an economist. He wasn't somebody who was expected, and I suspect that a lot of the economic and banking worlds had a good cry today because they really were expecting one of their own to be elevated. But he's a tremendously accomplished university president, a physician, very experienced in development and poverty. He gets around the one thing that is the big criticism of the World Bank, which is that it has this white man's burden, right? Yeah. Here's somebody with an understanding of international economies.
Does it matter, Cardiff, that he's not a diplomat or a politician or an economist?
That's tough to say. I mean, I'd make a couple of points about the selection. I mean, my own reaction, I think, was probably representative of a lot of journalists, which is that it went from, hey, who's that guy,
right,
to, wow, not bad, as I started reading about it. But so the first thing I'd say is that it's not mutually exclusive to say that he's a very qualified candidate, and he really does seem to be, and also that the selection process is still a little bit flawed and that it does sort of give an advantage to whoever the Americans pick. He is very likely going to be the next World Bank president. And the second thing I'd say is that it's very difficult to anticipate in advance how good somebody's going to be at this job, if only because there are so many variables that go into judging it, right? So it's hard to know right now if Bob Zoellick is a great World Bank president, because it's not like running a company where you have a bottom line. There are a lot of different metrics involved. And so I think this is one of those things where everybody should probably stay calm and just see how the process plays out and see how well he does.
We should explain briefly, Heidi, why the Americans get their pick of who gets to run the World Bank. You got 10 seconds, go.
Because we're economically powerful.
And we give the World Bank the most money, right?
Well, right. Yeah. Yes, he who has the gold makes the rules, right? The golden rule. Yeah.
Cardiff, I want to end with something you were all over early this morning. This company called BATS that tried to go public in New York this morning on the stock exchanges. It itself is a stock exchange, but it all went horribly wrong. Why does it matter, and what exactly happened?
Well, it went horribly wrong because the company was set to start trading today. Today was the day of its IPO. And when the company started trading, it had its own flash crash. And so those trades had to be canceled. And then it delayed the opening. And then after that, it essentially canceled it. Now, this is an alternative stock exchange, right, which tried to start trading on its own exchange. I mean, talk about something that's not going to give investors any confidence in the company. And this is all separate from what happened with Apple, which also had a technical glitch on BAT. So this was an awful day. The only winners were people who were writing headlines with puns. And really, that's about it. This was a horrible day for
BATS. Up to and including BATS that I can't say on the radio.
And, and mine, don't call it a cumbats.
Yes. All right. Anyway, we're all done. Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville and Heidi Moore in New York First. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you on Wall Street today. As Cardiff was saying, it was actually a happy-ish ending to kind of a so-so week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not unreasonable to call political Washington a circus, even on its calmest of days. But come Monday, when the Supreme Court's hearings on the health care law start, oh, look out. 3 days of oral argument, which means 3 days of the court's famous steps being crowded with activists and lawyers and journalists and tourists, too. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
In some cities, football is king, or people go batty over baseball. Here in Washington, the hottest ticket in town gets you into a courtroom.
There's certainly a nerd factor here.
Ian Millhiser is an attorney at the Center for American Progress. He really wants that hot Supreme Court ticket. Some tickets go to VIPs in advance, but ordinary mortals have to stand in line for a very long time. Millhiser plans to be at the court the night before the arguments start.
I am very much expecting a circus, yes. I doubt that there will be elephants there, but there will be a lot of lawyers.
Lawyers in suits. Yep, Millhiser will be camping out in his Sunday best.
If you're an attorney in the Supreme Court room, you wear a suit.
Teresa Browngold isn't wearing a suit. She's standing outside the court in sensible shoes, black stretchy pants, and a light sweater. Her accessories? A big sign and a portrait. Browngold is an artist-turned-protester. She paints portraits of the uninsured. Her sign talks about real access to health care. She'll be here at 6:30 Monday morning. She's prepping for the day like a marathon runner.
I have to eat certain things the day before, and then I start my morning like with hot water. so that I can stand all day and not have to run to the bathroom. I mean, we're
Jennifer Stefano is making protest plans, too. She heads a chapter of the conservative group Americans for Prosperity. She's helping organize a demonstration against the health care law. She has to get 12 busloads of Pennsylvanians to Washington next week.
It's a hectic, mad scramble.
And the scrambling will continue once Stefano gets here. Stefano's protesters will just stay for a day. She might stay overnight. She's noticed Washington hotels jack up their rates during big events. She's contemplating a friend's couch, but remembering an old Ben Franklin saying about houseguests.
Houseguests and fish go bad after 3 days. And so you have to be careful. You can't overstay your welcome.
But some people in Washington will welcome the messy mix of protesters, press, and tired lawyers. John Volanos owns the Monocle Restaurant, just 3 blocks from the Supreme Court. It's a favorite haunt of legislators, lobbyists, and lawyers.
Like I say, we see a lot of pinstripes if they're arguing the case in front of the Supreme Court, and larger briefcases to be checked.
The pinstripes might be competing for tables with tourists. Volanos sees a lot of them in the spring during Washington's annual Cherry Blossom Festival, which, by the way, starts on Sunday. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner is going to be in the Supreme Court chambers next week for the arguments, which means he's going to be here and on the Morning Report every day explaining what happened and why it matters. You know, largely lost in all the talk about the healthcare law is that a lot of things haven't really changed yet. Most of its provisions are going to phase in over time, which means millions of people still don't have health insurance and healthcare costs continue to climb. Commentator and physician John Schumann says conventional wisdom among his peers is sometimes responsible for those rising costs.
Nora, a third-year medical student, came to me in distress. Ms. DeFazio, one of the patients on her hospital rotation, was frightened to undergo an invasive and expensive medical procedure in which a catheter would be inserted into the heart to test whether she had heart disease. At the bedside, the doctor Nora was shadowing demanded to know why Ms. DeFazio refused the procedure. When no reason beyond "I don't want to" was offered, the doctor told Ms. DeFazio there was no longer any reason for her to stay in the hospital. But by declining the procedure, he informed her she would have to sign out against medical advice, or AMA. She would have to acknowledge that leaving AMA could result in serious harm or death, and that she would bear responsibility for all hospital charges not reimbursed by insurance because of her decision. The threat of a huge hospital bill got Ms. DeFazio to stay and take the test, Nora told me. It just seems so wrong to bludgeon a patient this way, she said. Can it possibly be true? Ethically, the notion that patients must do our bidding or pay the price seemed dubious. Yet in a world of copays, deductibles, and pre-existing conditions, the idea seemed plausible. To find out for sure, I elicited the help of some colleagues, and we sifted through nearly 10 years of discharges against medical advice from our teaching hospital. Out of the hundreds of cases we examined, not one resulted in an unpaid bill because of the AMA discharge. I also went to the source and talked with folks from some of the nation's largest private insurance companies. Each of them told me that the idea of a patient leaving against medical advice and having to foot the bill is bunk, nothing more than a medical urban legend. So patients, beware. The next time you or your loved one has decided that it's time to leave the hospital, don't let us doctors coerce you into staying by threatening you with the bill. It simply isn't true.
Dr. John Schumann specializes in internal medicine at the University of Oklahoma School of Community Medicine. That's in Tulsa. Coming up, the Mad Men? Oh, they had it easy.
The pressure is far, far greater on ad execs today to deliver real results.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials added 34 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 13,080. The NASDAQ tacked on 4 points, 0.1%, 3,067. The S&P 500 also gained 4 points, 0.3%, ended things at 1,397. Not a good week for the Dow, though, the worst in 3 months, actually. The Dow slipped 1.1%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.5%. The NASDAQ, though, that rose 0.4%. It was a day of technical glitches, as Cardiff Garcia was telling us. Bats, we told you about. Shares of the parent companies of the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ each lost 0.8%. Glitches also caused a mini 10% flash crash in Apple shares. Apple ended things down 0.5%. Good day for industrial blue chips. Caterpillar picked up 1.3%. Chevron gained about 1% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index for February. The Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism holds a field hearing at East Providence Senior Center in Rhode Island. The focus is healthcare fraud. And our favorite Vulcan celebrates a birthday. Actor Leonard Nimoy turns 81. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Justice Department is suing AT&T. The government says the company wrongfully collected millions of dollars from a federal program that helps the hearing impaired make phone calls. AT&T says it didn't know that foreign scammers were abusing the service, most of those scammers from Nigeria, as it turns out. And anytime the feds get stiffed out of millions of dollars, it's a problem. But what is it with all these fakes coming from Nigeria anyway? Marketplace's Eve Tro got that assignment this morning.
Look in your spam folder right now, and you'll likely find a message from a Nigerian prince. He needs your help to wire millions of dollars and says you'll be handsomely rewarded. But really, you'll just have your identity stolen. Tech writer Chris Null says Nigerian scams exploded in the 1990s when the country's oil industry busted and internet cafes were taking off.
There were a lot of people with some communication skills that knew English, that knew some technology, and they were suddenly unemployed, and they turn to crime.
He says Nigerians have been doing this for decades now because it actually works. The FBI says scams lure millions of dollars every year.
I'm sure it's been passed on from father to son, and it's proven successful. So why stop?
The AT&T case shows how Nigerian scams have evolved. Scammers took stolen credit card numbers and made big orders from U.S. companies over the phone. To mask their identity, they use something called the IP relay system. It lets disabled people type messages online and send them as phone calls. The operator reads the message to the recipient, and the government pays back the phone company for this service. But only for domestic users. The Department of Justice says AT&T knew most of these requests came from Nigeria and took reimbursement anyway. Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies says that'll be hard to prove.
I think it's a blind eye is the way you describe it. And the question is, to what degree shouldn't you have been blind?
AT&T says the scammers abused the system unbeknownst to the company, just as they would with the post office or an email provider. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to go back to last Friday to start letters off, and the story our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz did about Apple and Mike Daisy. Daisy's dramatic story of his visit to one of Apple's main suppliers in China, Foxconn, turned out to be largely fabricated. Bob Loza from Burbank, California, wanted to make sure we all see the bigger picture.
If you have a legitimate beef against Chinese factory conditions, make sure you include all manufacturers, not just the evil Apple. If not, I can only assume that you have already thrown your iPad and iPhone into the trash, never to be used again.
Mr. Loza recorded that sound by himself, by the way, on his iPhone, as it turns out. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson's story about a Washington, D.C. diaper bank lit up the Marketplace inbox this past week. The bank has gotten a $20 million donation of disposable Huggies to hand out to poor families. But before you could say really messy blowout, the listener conversation turned into the Great American Diaper Debate, including this from Amy Martindale of Sand Springs, Oklahoma.
I so wish you had mentioned that cloth diapers are a very viable alternative. Not those old school diapers with pins and plastic pants, but new cute reusable diapers in fantastic colors with snaps and Velcro.
We went to Las Vegas Wednesday for a sit-down with President Obama. We talked energy and the economy at a solar facility out in the Nevada desert. No interview is ever perfect, of course, but Shell Anderson from Durham, North Carolina, wasn't happy with my manners.
I'm not one of those folk who take umbrage at everything, but I thought you were less polite talking to our president than when you do those corner office interviews with the big bosses. Just saying.
Talk to us rudely, politely. Let your conscience be your guide. Marketplace.org is where you do it. Just click on that link that says contact. If you're part of the cult of Mad Men, The Rapture for you arrives this weekend. The series, built around the advertising industry of the 1960s, finally returns for a fifth season on Sunday night. Chain-smoking, womanizing, whiskey-swilling Don Draper is still the hottest thing on Madison Avenue, but how do you suppose he'd do today? We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith in search of the new icons of Madison Avenue.
Martini, anyone? After all, Don Draper and co. are almost never without a cocktail. But here at the bar in New York's Alex Hotel, Rupal Parikh of Advertising Age says Draper would find today's advertising industry sobering.
I think if Don saw what the industry was like today, I don't know that he would go into advertising. The pressure is far, far greater on ad execs today to deliver real results.
The revolution of Don Draper's day was television, but now advertisers are dealing with a 24/7 audience on an array of new media, Facebook, YouTube, mobile apps, and the results of those ads can often be measured immediately. So Parikh says today's Don Drapers need a firm grasp of new technology. The line between tech company and ad agency is blurring.
Without a doubt, it is cool to be a geek on Madison Avenue now.
In the last couple years, Facebook, Google, and Yahoo have expanded their New York media and advertising offices. This year, online ad spending is expected to total nearly $40 billion, overtaking print for the first time and rapidly gaining ground on TV.
We're a far cry from Sterling Cooper.
Torrance Boone is the managing director of Google's internal advertising department. Google's been snapping up advertising awards and even created a Super Bowl spot.
Our role is almost like a translator or a liaison between Madison Avenue and all of the amazing things that we have internally at Google.
Boone points to a recent project where Google helped revamp iconic ads from the Mad Men era. This 1971 Coke ad was developed by ad giant McCann Erickson. Google worked with the original art director to re-release the ad and use social media to give it a contemporary twist. Now you actually can buy the world a Coke, kind of. If you click on an online ad, you can send a free Coke to someone in a faraway city. The person can pick it up at a specialized vending machine and record a thank you video, like this one from Cape Town.
I thank you very much for the Coke that you gave me. I enjoy it and I appreciate it.
Boone says he hopes efforts like these will help advertisers see new possibilities for interactive ads.
By combining technology with creativity, we'll get more transformative advertising that is of a higher utility to consumers.
But even with all of the new possibilities for ads, some lessons from the old school still apply, says Stuart Alver, executive vice president at McCann. Alver says the ability to create an emotional response to a product is more important than ever. He points to a well-known scene in Mad Men when Don Draper pitches his ad campaign for Kodak's new slide projector.
It's a time machine. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again.
The way he transforms what the product benefit is into this emotional benefit for buyers of the product, that's what is most fundamental about advertising.
That emotional benefit is especially crucial in the age of social media, says Matt Donovan, a managing partner at McCann.
I think the old trying to sell things is actually not what we're focused on now.
Wait, advertisers are no longer focused on selling things? Donovan says, no. Instead, they're focused on inspiring consumers enough that they sell things to each other by liking a company on Facebook, tweeting about an ad campaign, or yelping a review.
I could see a world in 10 years where people proactively take on the responsibility of creating branded content on behalf of their favorite brand or product that they're passionate about.
For most of us, recommendations from friends are more powerful than an ad, says Horizon Media analyst Brad Adgate. He says social media has turned us all into little advertising megaphones.
It's no longer a top-down approach where the advertiser will send a message down to consumers. We all have bully pulpits, and there's more of a give and take.
Adgate says more and more we're using our bully pulpits to promote products to our friends. So really, the new Don Draper is you.
Sal, I'll take that drink now.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the downside of the slingshot to economic superstardom that Jim Yong Kim got today when the White House nominated the president of Dartmouth College to head the World Bank. The voice you're about to hear, believe it or not, will soon be one of the most influential people in development economics.
I came up in here to rock, light a fire, make it hot. I'm here rooting for my idols, up here giving all they got. So come on.
Yeah, he's rapping. It was a Dartmouth Idol contest last year. You do kind of shudder to think what videos are out there of you, don't you? I do, actually, to be honest with you. This, however, is one that has to be seen to be believed. The link is online. It's marketplace.org. All right, that's it. We're done on a Friday. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 34 points, about a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ tacked on 4 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 also gained 4 points. That is 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, Kurt Edwards became a nurse to recover from the Great Recession. Turns out there are some unexpected benefits.
Kurt is not an ugly man, okay? You got all these female workers and they're all looking at him like, oh, potential husband. So, yes, it does change.
The Comeback Chronicles, a partnership with the New York Times and Marketplace Money. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We are back here on Monday, same as we always are. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.